like Geshe-la says, you know, locking away all your merit and virtuous activities to enlightenment, and so therefore you can enjoy it all the way, right? Not just resulting in happiness and pleasure in this life, but something that'll be with you continuously all the way to enlightenment. So let's dedicate this for the long life of our teachers, for the good conditions for these persons that we're saying prayers to, for the success of Geshe-la's teachings and his works, and also for the long life of all our gurus and teachers. May whatever virtue I have gathered here beneficially serve all sentient beings and the Buddha Dharma, and especially may the essential teachings of the unerring Master Tsongkhapa shine forever. So this is the mantra for Lama Tsongkhapa. We'll recite that three times. It really shows the different aspects of Tsongkhapa, his compassion, his wisdom, and his power, a sense of real ability to overcome negativities. So we'll recite that three times. De Tsongkhapa, crown jewel of the holy masters of the land of snows, you are Avalokiteshvara, great treasure of inconceivable compassion, untainted by ego's delusion. You are Manjushri, powerful master with stainless wisdom. You are Vajrapani, destroyer of horses of demons. At your feet, famed Losangkhapa, I humbly bow and earnestly request that all sentient beings achieve enlightenment. De Tsongkhapa, crown jewel of the holy masters of the land of snows, you are Avalokiteshvara, great treasure of inconceivable compassion, untainted by ego's delusion. You are Manjushri, powerful master of stainless wisdom. You are Vajrapani, destroyer of forces of demons. At your feet, saying Losangkhapa, I humbly bow and earnestly request that all sentient beings achieve enlightenment. De Tsongkhapa, crown jewel of the holy masters of the land of snows.
You are a
untainted by ego's delusion. You are Manjushri, powerful master with stainless wisdom. You are Vajrapani, destroyer of forces of demons. At your feet, famed Losangkhapa, I humbly bow and earnestly request that all sentient beings achieve enlightenment. So the next three verses are really calling the Lama to the crown of your head. Again, this is working with visualization, a very powerful aspect of meditative practice. So you call the Lama to sit, it's a visualization, no, made of light, facing in the same direction as you. So it's a very tiny image. And so that's the first verse. The second verse, you ask the teacher to sit at the lotus seat at your heart, right? So you imagine the guru descending through your central channel, through your crown chakra and central channel, and then residing at your heart chakra. And then with the third verse, then becomes steadfast or inseparable from your own enlightened potential. Okay, so we'll recite those three verses. Precious Guru, glorious, precious root Guru, please take the lotus seat at my crown, and in your kindness, please care for us. Bestow upon us the attainments of your body, speech, and mind. Glorious, precious root Guru, please take the lotus seat at our hearts, and in your great kindness, care for us. Grant us your blessings for our temporal success and for the supreme attainment. Glorious, precious root Guru, please take the lotus seat at our hearts, and in your great kindness, remain with us. This is our request until we achieve the lesson of enlightenment.
Thank you.
So the this next verse and the short mantra are really about the essence of wisdom, really thinking about the nature of conditioned existence and enlightenment. So call to mind your understanding of emptiness and wisdom and compassion, and then we'll recite this verse. So think about how nothing is independent, inherently existent, that all things are causally conditioned, that they don't have permanence. I'll recite this verse. Unthinkable, inexpressible, wisdom gone beyond. Unborn, unceasing, space-like in essence, clearly perceived by wisdom mind, homage to the mother of the Buddhas of the three times. Gone, gone, gone beyond, gone completely beyond, so be it. Gone, gone, gone beyond, gone completely beyond, so be it. Gone, gone, gone beyond, gone completely beyond, so be it. So we'll sit quietly for a moment, contemplating this nature of existence. So I'll do the mandala offering again, like we did in the offering before, really create beautiful offerings, mandala of the universe and all realms around you. Offer it to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Offer it to the Buddha and your enlightened potential at your own heart as well. By the virtue of offering to you, assembly of Buddhas, visualize before me this mandala built on a base, resplendent with flowers, saffron, water, and incense, adorned with Mount Meru and the four continents, as well as with the sun and the moon. May all sentient beings share its effects. Idam Guru Ravna Mandala Kamnyatayami. And we'll recite the refuge prayer. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddhas, the Dhamma, and the highest assembly, from the virtuous merit of listening to teachings. May I attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddhas, the Dhamma, and the highest assembly, from the virtuous merit of listening to the Dhamma. May I attain Buddhahood to the benefit of all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the highest assembly, from the virtuous merit of teaching the Dharma. May I attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. So taking a verse from the Guru Puja, Lama Topa, regarding our human life, realizing how this body of liberties and endowments is found but once, is difficult to obtain, and is easily lost. We seek your blessings to partake of its essence, make it worthwhile, and not be distracted by the meaningless affairs of this life. So, in setting a motivation for this class, you know, for doing our practice, for doing our meditations, there are considered three different motivations. Does somebody know them right off the top? Three different classical motivations in doing practice. Okay.
To be free from samsara.
Okay.
To
be free from samsara. Okay, that's an excellent one. But generally, they talk about how when we take refuge, right, you say someone with an initial motivation, right, an initial motivation is that they go for refuge because they want a peaceful death. Okay. And then the second, the middling motivation for going for refuge, is that they want a good rebirth. And then the third, the highest motivation for going for refuge, is that you want to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. But actually, you know, when you think about it, most of us aren't even at the initial motivation. Because we don't even think we're going to die. In fact, you know, we keep putting it off and extending it someplace way far beyond ourselves. You know, that it's something that is, well, maybe it's going to happen, but not today, not next year, not the next 10 years. Something that happens to other people occasionally, but not to me. You know, so when you really think about it, the Dharma is asking you to think more deeply about the nature of our life and the condition of our existence. Right, David, it's like when we get sick, you start thinking about it a little bit, but then when you get better, it starts getting far away again, you know? It's like you get diagnosed with cancer or some really difficult sickness and you start thinking about death and impermanence or sickness. And then you're well and you go out and play. You know? It's something that we just keep pushing far away from ourselves, and yet this is the nature of our existence. And so thinking about how this body of liberties and endowments, right? What is its essence and how is it precious? Geshe-la keeps saying, you know, we don't see it as precious because we already have it, right? We don't think of this body as something exceptional because, you know, it's ours, it's mine. We already have it. But when you look at the other conditions of other life forms, right, there's six in the Buddhist cosmology, you realize that our human birth is the one that gives us the opportunity and just the right sprinkling of suffering and happiness so that we're not constantly, we understand its nature, you know, that we can't have constant happiness and be totally free from suffering. No? That because of those conditions of having that balance, that mixture, it helps us to develop some sense of renunciation. No? But we keep forgetting, and this is what spiritual practice is about, so that we contemplate the impermanent nature of our life. So that's one of the three natures of samsara, three natures of our life. One of them is that it's impermanent. So what are the other two? Any offerings from the floor?
Don't know when it'll end.
Okay. Well, that's part of impermanence. OK. Okay? They call them the three natures, three conditions of cyclic existence. Nature of suffering, okay, first noble truth. Nature of suffering, okay, we've got impermanence, suffering, and what's the third one? Was that from you? Oh, thank you. Okay, emptiness, no self. Okay, so those are the conditions, okay, the nature of cyclic existence is that it's impermanent, nature of suffering, and no self, okay? So we need to know the nature of our existence. And that will really help us develop a little more oomph in our Dharma practice. until we do, it's very watered down and very weak, very wispy. You know, it's like we keep searching for pleasure, permanence, and a real self in samsara, which is not its nature, you know. And as we keep running around and doing that, you know, Lama Yeshe says, our minds are constantly restless and we're berserk. Yeah, we run around with this berserk mind, trying to create lasting, permanent happiness and finding an existent self in samsara. Okay, so what we need to do is try to understand the condition, the nature of our existence, and when we do, then we can develop a little more lasting loving kindness for others, really evoke a sense of natural compassion that will arise, you know, and also real renunciation. Until we do, we're just kind of how do you say that? We're traumatized, confused, and just paralyzed in samsara. When I left Colorado, some of the students gave me these mugs, these coffee mugs, and what they did was they signed little messages on them as a farewell gift from my party. And a girl had been studying with me for about a year, and she wrote, "Oh, she who awakens samsara." And I thought, that's one of my students saying I'm awakening samsara. But I also thought, isn't that great? You know, because until we know what samsara is, we're asleep in it. We're really asleep in it. So I thought, okay, that's fine, you know. She who awakens samsara, so that we can understand its conditioned existence. Okay, so I wanted to read something from Aryadeva. Aryadeva was a direct disciple of Nagarjuna and studied with Nagarjuna. So they make an assertion and he writes these poems, you know. Anyway, this assertion about our body and the nature of our existence is, if the body's nature were suffering, it would be unnecessary for the teacher, the Buddha, to say that the body is suffering. Just as there's no need to point out that the sun is hot. Okay, so this assertion is presented. And the answer is, there is no fault, for though the body's nature is suffering, because of confusion, one doesn't realize it, and thinking it is pleasurable, one cycles in samsara. Okay? We keep cycling in samsara. So Aryadeva's verse is, common beings must be told, you are not free from attachment to suffering. What a thought, we're attached to suffering. And that is because we don't understand the condition or the nature of our existence. We keep trying to eke out happiness, lasting happiness, in what, if we really analyze, leads to suffering. Okay. So why is this a precious human birth then, if we face things like birth, sickness, aging, and death? Okay. Any answers from the floor?
Provides the condition to study the Dharma.
Provides the condition for studying the Dharma. Okay. Any other comments?
We all have the Buddha nature.
We all have Buddha nature. Yeah. I mean, even animals do, and all sentient beings do. But this precious human life.
There's not too much suffering, too much pleasure to prevent.
Do you want to hand in the mic? Can you...
There's not too much suffering or too much pleasure to prevent figuring it out.
Okay. Not too much pleasure, not too much suffering to prevent figuring it out. Well, that's naming the condition. Yeah, that's naming the condition. So it's really using this potential, right? This potential to attain liberation and enlightenment. That, you know, we can attain it as well. So it's not wasting this human life, not wasting our time and wasting this human life. We keep mistaking, you know, suffering for pleasure, and then we keep wanting to hang on to it, and then our life is gone. Okay. So looking at the nature of our life, right? We have these three qualities. In death and permanence, we talk about how death is inevitable. Okay, again, we push that away. Well, it might be inevitable, but I don't want to think about that now. Death is inevitable. What was the second one?
That's
the three natures. Okay, death is inevitable, but the time of death is indefinite. Okay, uncertain. We don't know when it's going to happen. So even if we're very healthy and we're eating the best foods, right, it doesn't guarantee that we're going to allay or delay our suffering. Right. And what's the third one? We extract lessons from our life. Night and day we should extract lessons from our life. What were you going to say? Death is inevitable. It's going to happen. At the time of death, only the Dharma, only your spiritual path practice can help you. Think about all you're running around, running after in this life, okay? It says, partake of its essence and make it worthwhile, and not be distracted by the meaningless affairs of this life. Think about all we run after. Okay? And this last point, that only the Dharma can help us at the time of death. So, Even our body has to be abandoned. Even our body that we take such good care of cannot help us at the time of death. And you think about how much energy we put into taking care of this body or fixing it up. Yeah, it's like a mask, right? A mask of trying to fix it up. So Aryadeva also says, you know, isn't it curious, right, that we want long life but we don't want to be old? Yeah, there's a little contradiction there, you know. And they also talk about how our body when we're young is more of a source of pleasure, but as we get old it's a source of pain. But when I look back at being young, there was a lot of suffering being young too, isn't it? You know, like, remember eighth grade? Yeah? Or remember when your wisdom teeth were coming in? We keep forgetting. It's like we have this kind of short-term memory loss. you know, about how this body is so pleasurable. So I was thinking this morning, you know, we keep seeing this body as a source of pleasure and happiness and lastingness. But what about, you know, don't do this one, okay? For the benefit of all beings, don't do this one, but think about it. If you did not wash your hands, bathe, change your clothes, brush your teeth, or floss for a month, where would there be pleasure in this body? No. So really thinking about how we tend to view, you know, bodies, some bodies as really attractive and some as really aversive, and our own body that way too. Sometimes we're really attracted by our own image, and then other times we're really like turned off by our own image. So to just observe and think, you know, how confused we are. He says, this is the worst confusion of all. Yeah. How we are not free from attachment to suffering. Okay, so there's another aspect about suffering. Suffering has three qualities. So who would like to share what those are? Three natures of suffering.
Suffering of change.
Suffering of change, okay. Can you give me an example of that?
When you run out of money.
If you had some, right? If you had. Okay, suffering of change, okay. It means really some pleasurable condition that shifts into suffering, right? So this is the main one actually that Aryadeva is talking about, right? We think things are pleasurable, but in fact their nature is suffering. Yeah. When you penetrate or deeply think about any one of those things that we think are pleasure, in fact its nature is suffering. That's what samsara is. She who awakens samsara, right? If you really penetrate this nature of what is pleasant, in fact, what it is a temporary situation of not suffering. That's samsara. Yeah, it's insidious. Okay, what's another suffering?
Pervasive suffering.
Okay, what's pervasive suffering?
If you've experienced a severe illness or accident, maybe quadriplegia, maybe a mental depression as well as physical.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so experiencing being very severely sick or a long-term sickness, yeah, this is a condition of our existence. In fact, you know, that's our whole condition, right? And we don't recognize it. We don't recognize it, which is another reason why they say this essence of our human life is for us to wake up to the condition, you know, to its nature, so that we don't just relax in samsara and think we've got all the time in the world and I'm just going to go rollerblading or, you know, watch television or something, that we forget, you know, there's this side of balancing out our life so that we have some leisure. That's also a condition of our life, right? We have a little leisure, we have a little fortune, yeah? But it's also considering this suffering nature. We're bound to die. 100 years from now, none of us will be here. And given that fact, you know, how do you want to use your life and utilize it? So it's a pervasive condition. Yeah, we face birth, sickness, aging, and death. Yeah. Okay, so all of us are born now, so we face all the other three conditions: aging, sickness, and death. And boy, yeah, it's like the upkeep. My goodness. Okay, so there's one more condition of suffering. Okay, Glenn.
Is it called the suffering of suffering?
The suffering of suffering. Boy, you Buddhists are so... The suffering of suffering. Yeah. But again, to look at the nature of our existence. Okay, Glenn, what's the suffering of suffering? Can you give me an example of that? He can't remember. Want to give me an example?
Migraine. Any obvious manifest?
Overt. Overt suffering. Yeah. Actual suffering. Hand in the fire suffering. Right? Physical and mental suffering. That's overt suffering. So that's the suffering of suffering. And then, so that's the one that is our big classification of cyclic existence. That's the one that we want to get away from, isn't it? The suffering of suffering. And we experience this because our body and mind are under the condition of our karma and our delusions. Okay? So pleasant experiences and pleasant feelings, pleasant conditions, things that we observe as pleasurable. These are the suffering of change. So a characteristic of this, again, is that it's fluctuating and unstable. Yeah, you think about any of the happiness that you have or experience, and how we keep trying to cling to it or nail it down or have it stay with us forever, isn't it? Whatever happiness that we have, we keep trying to hang on to it. But it's, you know, it's like one of those toys that won't stay in your hand. Suffering of change, pleasurable experiences that shift into suffering. Okay, so then our body and mind are again governed by this karma and delusion, and we can't control it very well, although, you know, in fact, we're out of control. We're out of control. And so this is called pervasive suffering. And so what's is that our precious human rebirth then is utilizing the opportunity to understand and free ourselves from cyclic existence. To free ourselves from it, okay? So just wishing it away or just going rollerblading and thinking I'll take care of it next month isn't really going to handle it. You need to bring attention to it. Oh, she who wakens samsara, right? You need to look at it, understand its conditions, and then work with it, okay? And so that's where it's coming from, realizing that we're creating all the conditions for the rest of our life. And for our future life, if you believe in that, right? In the Tibetan tradition, Tibetan Buddhist tradition, yes, definitely. We're creating the conditions for our future lives right now by what we do, think, and act upon. Yeah? So we need to really observe that. And then when you think deeply about it, you develop a sense of intolerance of the nature of samsara. You develop a deep sense of the nature of suffering and want to get out of it and to watch your actions of body, speech, and mind. So knowing the conditions, you know, that we're just getting sick, we're getting old, we have to face our death, then what you do is observe the 10 virtuous actions, right? The Tibetan word for Buddha is Sangye. Tibetan word for Buddha is Sangye. Sang means that you have purified all negativities, all delusions. Okay? And Ge means an expansion, a flowering of all virtuous conditions. And so when you think about the Noble Eightfold Path and the path to enlightenment, the Buddhas are saying that's your avenue. That's your avenue, and that's what you need to take up. It's not saying that there's nothing to do and it's hopeless, right? Like His Holiness says, if in fact, you know, why talk about suffering if there's no liberation from suffering? if there's no liberation and no exit, then he says, go have a good time. Right? But if in fact we can be liberated from this and there's a path to attain it, then we need to find all the ways that we can attain this. Right? So just like the Buddha, to purify all negativities and all delusions and to expand and really have flourish all our positive virtuous qualities, that's what we need to work on. Okay? So Buddha, like Geshe-la says, Buddha was just like us, but he followed the path. He created this path and he showed us the way. He showed us the way. There's another teacher that I studied with, and he talked about how, you know, there's some teachings that are very beautiful, very flowery, very illuminating, but there's no path. So whatever you study, you need to really check up, is there a way, and what are these teachings taking you to? So if you study with different teachers or books or paths, you know, really examine, what is it doing? Where is it going? What is it heading to? Or is it just making you feel good? No. So this teacher said, it's like, you know, if there's a teaching with no path, then it's like looking at a Momo under glass. Okay? It's like a delicious, savory dumpling under glass, right? You see it and it's mouth-watering, but you can't get to it. Okay? So you need to look and see if there's a path and what you can do to attain it. Okay, so so there's the nature of suffering, the nature of impermanence, and then the third one is no self, right? Understanding that there are causes and conditions, that who we are now, how we perceive the world, how we act upon the world, also came from causes and conditions. Robert Thurman has a beautiful way of using English and creating the terminology for us to understand these concepts, you know, and views. He says that the Buddha created infinite excellent relativities, yeah, to create the condition to be a Buddha. And you think about how, right, we take up the path to really purify negativities and accumulate virtuous qualities, right? So there's the fifth vow in our refuge precepts. Do you know what that one is? The fifth precept, what is that? Or let's go through the five of them. What is first one? For those of you who took refuge, huh? Not to kill. No sexual misconduct. No stealing. No lying. No intoxicants. Okay? So those five precepts. Now, when it says here in our general prayers, right, the Vinaya, Bodhisattva, and Vajrayana are three vows. Vinaya, that's your Vinaya vow as a lay person. Not to kill, not to steal, not to lie, not to commit sexual misconduct, and no intoxicants. So this fifth one is no intoxicants, right, is one that's pretty hard for Westerners to take. Yeah, Geshe-la is so kind, and he says, if you take the refuge precepts, you know, you must take at least one, right? You must take at least one. And then there's one where a lot of Westerners in discussions in the past, I don't know how it is now, but I think probably the same, right? They say, well, I can take all of them except the intoxicants one, right? Because I still like to imbibe or whatever it is. But when you think about it, right, that's the one that's saying, I want to make my mind clear, right? I want to make my mind clear, lucid, and able to comprehend the nature of reality, to look at the condition of existence, right? When we're taking intoxicants, what we're doing is numbing out our experience, and then we're not looking at the nature of reality, isn't it? And so this one is actually very powerful. But, you know, we go kicking and screaming. Yeah, we want enlightenment, but we want all our toys. Yeah? So it's the sense of really looking at how, you know, the Buddha was not trying to torture us. He's saying, if you want enlightenment, this is what you need to do. This is the way to do it. He's showing you the path, right? And so it's saying this one of no intoxicants is your promise to yourself that you're going to wake up to this suffering in your life, to the potential, the Buddha nature, to your potential of enlightenment in your life. That's what you're aiming for, right? And so it's this profound path that he created, and looking at it, you know, looking at our death, looking at our inevitable death, is really scary. We want to push it away. We don't want to go there. But it's where we all have to go. You know, these people here, 54, 45, and 45 years old. You know, now that I'm the age I am, that's really young to me. When I was 20, it seemed like they were the other generation, you know. But in fact, we all have to go. And so this meditation, you know, our practice, the path, is so that we can look at this reality and truly develop renunciation, truly develop a sense of compassion, seeing everyone in your life around you, friends, enemies, strangers, loved ones, co-workers, you know, we're all in the same boat. And when you really think about the suffering, impermanent nature of existence, then a natural, spontaneous compassion can arise. Yeah. So let's sit with that for a few minutes. Let's look at that in our own experience. So just do a quick body scan. Notice if there's any tension or holding or pain anywhere, and adjust yourself so that you can sit easily and comfortably. Think about how your life is right now and of its infinite relativities, your parents and your familial lineage, your mind and your interests and aspirations, and think about the condition of our lives. No matter who we are, death is inevitable. think about all the things that we do to sustain and provide for our lives. And as one teacher said, in fact, we're like a sprinter sprinting to our death. From the time we were conceived, because of conditioned existence, we were born, and therefore death is inevitable. And then consider how the time of death is uncertain. Look at where you rationalize and think, well, I'm young now, so it'll be sometime in the future. If it is inevitable, it'll be sometime in the future. Observe how if you are 40 years old, you think, well, I've got several more decades left. Or if I'm 70 years old, I think, well, a lot of people live to 100 these days. And then the third quality, that only your spiritual practice, only the Dharma can help you at the time of death. Your friends and family cannot help you. Your doctor and medicine cannot help you. And even your body abandons you. So considering that this is the nature of our existence, then how do you want to live your life? Think about that. So contemplate the verse. Realizing how this body of liberties and endowments is found but once, is difficult to obtain, and is easily lost, we seek your blessings to partake of its essence, make it worthwhile, and not be distracted by the meaningless affairs of this life. Also add to your contemplation the nature of what we cling to, what we perceive as happiness. And another saying from my teachers, like flickering oil lamps that last a few minutes, happiness is an illusion and lasts like a bubble. A dream, a lightning flash, or a day. All conditioned phenomena are like this. Okay, you can come out of your meditation. So when we don't remember impermanence and death, then our practice is not very strong. We procrastinate and put things off. Our aspiration to assist others, even our loving kindness, is very weak. We develop wrong views. We cling to things of this life, which are in fact impermanent. Right? Just as a meditation or an analysis of our body goes, no, you should really consider all conditioned phenomena the same way. In fact, our body is such a teacher for us, such a teacher. But we keep trying to make it more beautiful or younger, or, you know, we're really pleased when someone says, "Oh my gosh, you look 10 or whatever, however many years younger than you really are," right? And then we're really downcast when they say, "Oh, I thought you were, you know, something that's a little bit higher, even 6 months higher than what we." Yeah. So you watch how the mind is so fickle and is just kind of rising and falling with these things. But, you know, you develop more stability and equanimity when you develop this real comprehension. You know, we're all in the same boat. Yeah. In this condition. So the three conditions again were impermanent, suffering, and no self. Yeah. No permanent, inherent, lasting self. Our body came from our parents, right? And from our environment and the food and the way we take care of it. And our mind came from our previous moment of mind. And what we're doing, it's like we're just feeding ourselves all the time, creating more and more causes and conditions. Like, you know, like Thurman says, the infinite relativities. Yeah, creating the causes and conditions for an excellent future. An excellent future by abstaining from killing, stealing, lying, sexual misconduct, and intoxicants, right? Our five precepts. I mean, you know, it's just like a recipe the Buddha gave us, right? The recipe for enlightenment. He says, I did this and you can do this too, right? The path. You follow the path and you can attain this. And so really, not being distracted by the meaningless affairs of this life. Yeah. So that at the time of death, which is inevitable, right, you have no regrets. Right? So that gets us up to the initial level. That gets us up to the initial level. That at the time of death, we don't regret. That we have a peaceful death. Yeah. And so this whole side on the bodhisattva vow, really thinking of with compassion, understanding that all sentient beings are friends and loved ones, our enemies and our strangers, right? Are sharing this condition, that we develop the compassion and then the bodhicitta wish that I'm going to be the one, right? It's not saying, well, Geshe-la can do it and somebody else can do it and then they can help me along. But this bodhisattva view is, I'm the one, right? Remember Buddha's first words when he was born? Of all two-footed beings, I'm the best, right? This is my last birth. Creating the conditions, right? Thurman again said, he was like Muhammad Ali, right? I'm the best. I'm the one, right? So that's what we have to do. We have to have that kind of motivation. I'm the one. I'm going to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. Yeah. And that'll give you incredible impetus, incredible propulsion to really take advantage of this life. Yeah, we have the guidelines of watching our precepts. So that's your guidelines, you know, watching when attachment and anger and aversion and confusion arise. We have the teachers to help us. You watch, if we don't look carefully at the nature of existence, right, we're just clamoring after these impermanent, elusive things, right? That's what we aspire to. And then, you know, if we get foiled or somebody prevents us from doing it, then we get angry and then we engage in really negative actions of body, speech, and mind because we're foiled from obtaining something elusive. Yeah? But enlightenment is not elusive. So it's a beautiful path, and we need to understand its condition, its nature, so that it'll help us in guiding ourselves. So I'll stop here, and if there are any questions or comments, I'll try to address them, and then we can say some prayers for these friends. Another condition of the body, right, this life, birth, sickness, aging, and death, striving so hard for what you want and not getting it, striving so hard for what you want, getting it, and then not wanting it, right, striving so hard for what you want, getting it, and then it getting ripped off from you, right? Even if you have it your entire life, at death, it's also got to be left behind. Okay? And it's so poignant when His Holiness says, you know, you work so hard, you strive so hard to find the right person in your life, the right partner, right? And you live together and you see each other aging. And He says, you look into each other's eyes helplessly, because you know you'll be torn away from this that you worked so hard for to cultivate. But it's like that with all our possessions and our own body. Yeah. So all of our relationships, all of our friends, enemies, and strangers arose through causes and conditions as well, right? Again, another, we keep seeing permanence in our friends and our enemies and our strangers, but in fact, they all came from the pool of strangers. Right? That's another elusive group. Friends become enemies, enemies become friends. What a funny world we live in. Yeah. But this is another reason to cultivate compassion. And wisdom to understand its nature so that we can help others and ourselves along the path and not get caught up in thinking that my friend was permanently my friend and how dare they have some other interest or whatever. So, no questions? Any questions? Uh-huh.
Well, I was just
wondering,
darling.
Do you want to give her that?
Are there any cases where it's
wait,
okay
can you
life?
Can you take that?
Going back to intoxicants, I was just wondering, are there any cases where it would be all right, say somebody's in terrible pain as a result of an accident or something like that?
Could everybody hear?
No.
Okay.
I don't think this is working.
Yeah. You have to speak more directly.
Oh, yeah. I was wondering about intoxicants in the case of somebody being in terrible pain, such as after an accident or something, where it's unbearable. I mean, I've been in that situation.
Yeah. So well, there is that side where it becomes medicine for us. It can alleviate the pain, can bring us back to more balance. So, you know, all of those things. It's just this path, right, is saying to tread the middle way. All of these things. You know, I mean, we have this tendency to be such extremists in our lives in the way of just working ourselves to the bone, right? Or playing ourselves to the bone, right? We're just so extreme. And that also, you know, with intoxicants, it's saying, when are you intoxicated? Now, when are you going over the edge? So it's this side where, you know, many people have interpreted the one on intoxicants. Well, a glass of wine with dinner isn't making me intoxicated, but, you know, it's when are you getting into abuse and just numbing yourself out? So that one for medication, you know, that's totally valid. Yeah. Can you hand the...
Your topic kind of brings up an aspect of suffering that has come up with several times in the week with different students here. How does the Dharma or Buddhism deal with the whole idea of the difference between, you know, within the whole thing of self-medication, of trying to keep ourselves asleep through intoxication or through, like you say, watching television or eating, all of these things that are sort of forms of self-medication to numb pain, the suffering of existence. It's hard to differentiate between where laziness stops and fear of going forward, you know, starts. Mm-hmm. Do you understand my question? Like, what is the differentiation? When am I just being lazy, and when am I actually afraid to go forward out of fear of going beyond this, you know, normal pain? Because I think this, you know, this is a self-medicating society. We all use intoxicants for various reasons.
Right. Well, this is where we need to gauge, you know, and balance and seeing, is my mind becoming clearer or not? You know, is it becoming something more dull and asleep or not? And we also need that balance, right? And I watch it coming back into the busyness of working with the center here. You know, I'm not going out for my walk, and I should be taking Annie with me, right? And getting some balance of exercise and this right balance, so that my mind is clear and I can work better and happily. Yeah. So it's a tough one. Because then, you know, we become absolute exercise buffs, pushing any buttons, where we can go into the other extreme too, you know. So it's like, how do we find the balance of bringing that into, you know, we do that with everything, with diet, with play, with you know, exercise, with lifestyle. So it's like, how do we bring that into balance and watching? So, you know, this whole side of moderation, right? Moderation is what the Buddha was implying. Like one of my vows as a nun, it was created during the time of the Buddha, that's 2,500 years ago, right? Is that I shouldn't ride in a vehicle. Well, you know, I mean, you have to look at the context of the situation that, you know, people who rode in vehicles were kings and extremely wealthy landlords and things like this. And so those were the only people who rode in vehicles, right? So now I can join all of you, right, and drive my Toyota. But
it's considered a vehicle?
I'm sorry?
An elephant
was considered a vehicle, yeah, right. I don't know if I told you folks here. I mean, one of the ones I confessed, right? Because as a nun, I wasn't supposed to go watch marching elephants, military elephants. And being the chaplain at the Air Force Academy, right, one day, last year President Bush was the keynote speaker for the graduating class, and they had all the Thunderbird jets going through, right? And so I went to go watch the Thunderbirds, and I went, I think this roughly equates to marching elephants. You know, but but it's looking at how do you balance and what are you engaging in, yeah? Your vows, your precepts are your gauge. Are your gauge, and looking at, you know, not making the mind really tight and tense. That's not the purpose of it. Not making you an ascetic, austere person who nobody wants to be around. You know, it's like, how do you work for the benefit of all beings with this dance of ease and really bringing joy and inspiration to others. So yeah, it's an interesting balance. Can you hand that just? It's going into the recording.
That's a point I think you really should address. I don't know how to describe it, but it's been described as a spiritual materialism, as being so convinced that one's particular point of view or path or interpretation of the path is the highest, the best, and the most wonderful.
Right.
That it turns into an object of attachment.
Yeah.
And
aversion for others.
Correct. And a way to create aversion for others and eventually for the self if you're not able to, you know, accomplish all the things you set out to do.
Yeah.
So it's very poignant.
It is very poignant. Yeah, we have to watch, you know, how we use our practice to just keep running our neuroses, right? It's really awful. There's the other side. Yeah, Alex Berzin coined the term when we're practicing, that we're actually practicing, we want to practice Dharma light, right? We don't want to think about death and suffering. You know, we just want to pacify. We want to pacify and just make our lives pleasurable. Yeah. Again, we're not even up to the level of the initial having a peaceful death. Yeah. So again, that's where's middle path with my spiritual practice. Yeah. Okay. Can you end that?
I'm really glad we're talking about this because
you have to turn it on.
Is that not?
I'm glad we're talking about this subject because this intoxicants. Because, you know, coming from the Judeo-Christian world, you know, thou shalt not means thou shalt not, and there's no, you know, it's all black and white. And so when I took my Dharma vows, you know, I really felt that there's no deviation and whatever I promised I have to do. So now, how do you balance the middle way, you know, and then these vows? Because, for instance, is it okay to lie a little, like to help somebody's feelings? Is it okay to drink a little because they offer you a glass? What exactly are we talking about? You think you could explain that?
Yeah, I mean, Geshe-la gives the classic example of if someone is running past you to avoid being killed, and then the potential murderer comes along and says, "Did you see him? And which way did he go?" You can say, aren't the flowers beautiful today, or, you know, whatever, you know, so that, one, you're preventing that person from committing a very heinous act, right? You're saving a life. But it is somewhat of a deviation, or, you know, it's lying to protect others. Again, there's the classic precepts, but the bodhisattva vows are higher than those precepts. The bodhisattva vows are higher than my monastic vows. For what is it for the benefit of all beings, you know? And this is where you really need to be practicing well to know, because there's a huge gray area, isn't there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So basically, intoxicants mean no intoxicants, generally speaking.
In general, no intoxicants means no intoxicants. Yeah, but, you know, sometimes it's cooked in your food or something, and you've gone to a friend's house, and, you know, to sit there and say, well, I don't, you know, it's like, again, middle way imbalance. Yeah.
Loud enough. Is this, can you hear me?
Yeah.
This is off the intoxicants, but in a way it is an intoxicant, because I am continuing to struggle finding any kind of compassion for the leaders of our country. And it's something that it's almost make, I mean, it's toxic for me. And I try. Every single day. How do you find that balance when you're so sure that there's so much wrong being done, and how to respond or react to this and be a citizen, but also have great compassion for those who are leading us?
Well, those people were put into office by us. So you get a sense of the trend of the powers that be at this particular time, you know? And so you need to keep working and looking and advocating and speaking up and working, you know, at letting them know your view. They're supposed to be an office for the people. That's what it's supposed to be. Yeah. So taking it to that level is quite an example of this. There's another expression of the conditions of existence, right? The hatred, the attachment, and ignorance as the three poisons, right? And there's a teacher who really looked at it on a more global area, saying attachment was like the rampant materialism that's going on in the world today, and the driving forces of advertising and big business and big corporate business. So that's like the poison of attachment. And then anger is the militarism to protect all those things. And then the ignorance is the global pollution that's going on all over the world and the planet. You know, so taking these three poisons that also perpetuate samsara is something very profound in the way of how, you know, when you say they're in office not really through us, you know, you're seeing how power and circumstance creates that kind of situation as well, you know. So we just have to create a strong voice, you know, a stronger voice. How can we do that? You know, it's quite insidious, isn't it?
People who are actually just saying, I can't deal with this anymore, I'm shutting it off, I'm not reading the newspapers, I'm not watching the news, I'm not listening to anything.
Yeah.
And I find myself saying, is that where I need to be to calm down? And then I can't. I keep writing letters, sending emails.
Well, that's great. That's great. But you have to watch where then, as you do this kind of work, you don't fall into despair, apathy, and sadness, or anger and hatred, you know? It's like, how do we keep speaking up to sickness and negativities in our society, you know, and really sustain a sense of balance? And this, again, is the middle path. You know, we need to keep nurturing ourselves, but we can't always stay in the nurturance. You know, there are times when we have to be activists ourselves. So it's developing, you know, how do we do that and sustain the buoyancy and energy without going into despair. So it's a hard practice, but something that we need to keep looking at, just as Tarso was saying too, you know, it's like what's the middle way with this? Okay. Okay, last question, I think. I think we need to let's let someone else answer, and then we can take. Who had a question? Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Just more of a comment addressing. I'm sorry. Who just made the last comment regarding Bush et al. Yeah. I'm sure a lot of us can relate to that. And technically, if you look at how he came into office this time and the last time, wasn't really legitimate, but he's in power now. So a couple of things that have helped me are, one, to realize from a karmic point of view, you know, legitimately elected, not really, but from a karmic point of view, yeah, you can look at them all as agents of karma. On the one hand, if that'll help accept the reality of the situation as it is now, and second, it's impermanent. He's not going to last. You know, he's on the way out, and his minions are on the way out. You know, so Rinpoche, His Eminence Kabushalari Rinpoche, and Geshe-la and His Holiness have mentioned repeatedly that on the one hand, these are degenerating times, from if you take the long view, but on the other hand. And it's kind of funny because they pinpointed the year 2000 right after he took office as being the lowest, the nadir, so that we are going up. It is going to improve, you know. And then if you stop and think about the kind of karma these people are creating for themselves, it'll be easy to have compassion for them. It'll be easy because, yeah, there you go. Because that's incredible what they're bringing on themselves by what they're doing to the others.
So
the individual
karma,
the
right.
Okay.
So that'll help.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll do the dedication of merits. And also, again, let's really dedicate our prayers to Walter, Jeff, Wanda, and Judy. And also for all sentient beings and people that we haven't mentioned today. Because of these merits, may I quickly become Guru Lord Buddha and lead each and every sentient being into his enlightened realm. May the precious bodhicitta that has not yet been received be received. And may that which has been received be increased and not decreased. May the precious view of emptiness, shunyata, that has not been received be received. And may that which has been received be increased and not decreased. By the virtue of offering to you assembly of Buddhas visualized before me, this mandala built on a base resplendent with flowers, saffron, water, and incense, adorned with Mount Meru and the four continents, as well as with the sun and the moon, may all sentient beings share its effects. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamyatayami. We'll say the long life prayer for His Holiness. in the snowy mountain land of snowy mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. Lord Chinmayasi Tenzin Gyatso, may you stay until samsara ends.
Okay. We'll do our bows together.
I like it. I really appreciate it.